OT After Dark is a podcast run by two occupational therapists and is for adults only. The views on this podcast are our own and are intended for information and educational purposes only. We believe that sex and sexual pleasure are a human right for consenting adults, regardless of ability, age, gender, or sexual orientation. We discuss topics that cover a wide variety of sex and sexual practices. To be true to our strong views regarding inclusivity, we use common and slang terms regarding sexual topics, which may be considered explicit. Listener discretion is advised.
We have exciting news to share. We recently partnered with DirectRec, a free app for OT practitioners, PT practitioners, and speech-language pathologists.
DirectRec helps clinicians to find peer-vetted products, and we recently have added our own recommendations of products on DirectRec for sexual health and wellness.
We helped DirectRec get a little extra sexy. DirectRec helps clinicians share products and other digital info, like YouTube videos and Google Docs, with their clients.
DirectRec helps you to track clients' follow-through on your product recommendations. So to start using DirectRec, click on the link on our website at otafterdark.com or in our social media bios.
Hi, I'm Kay.
And I'm JJ.
And we're both occupational therapists.
And we're here talking to you about sex.
Today we are talking to Sam Troia, an inpatient occupational therapist who's been, I guess we'd say, blazing a little trail where he works to get sex addressed more.
Yeah, he's really, he put together a team of other occupational therapists to really start addressing sex at his facility.
So let's take a listen to what he's been doing over there at MedStar.
All right, so we are here today with Sam Troia. He is an inpatient OT at MedStar National Rehabilitation Hospital. And he is here talking to us about how he addresses sex with his clients. So welcome, Sam. Thank you so much for being on OT After Dark.
Hey, guys. Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. All of this is very new for me. I'm actually from Omaha, Nebraska, and I went to Creighton University. And in your guys' first episode, you talked about one of the articles on kind of sex education, who's practicing, and one of my professors, Helene Lohman, was the one who kind of started this kind of movement in my eyes and kind of got the ball rolling. So she made us talk about sex in school, and she made us talk about how we're going to address it with our patients, especially in the aging population. Once I got to MedStar, I noticed it was something that was not spoken about whatsoever. And I went to some senior therapists, and I was like, I'm not sure if I feel comfortable with having this conversation. Is this my job? Like, I know they tell us that, but I want to make sure I know that I'm saying the right things. And what they ended up doing is the senior therapist said, you're right, this is a conversation that's not being had across the board. So we came together and started developing handouts and educational materials for the patients, but really for the therapist, so that the therapists know you have a patient who has a hip, who had a hip replacement. When can they return to sex, and what does that look like? What positions can they be in? What positions can't they be in? What are basic communication strategies for people who are hoping to return to sex? How do we know if something is supposed to, like, what is something supposed to feel after an injury? Being on the spinal cord team and pediatric team, I have this difficult mix. I've got phone call, another phone call coming in. Sorry about that. I've had this difficult mix between working with people who have lost function, like sexual function, and redefining intimacy and for people who know what sex is, people who have no idea what sex is. Mm-hmm. I've had 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds who've had spinal cord injuries. Some who day one, they asked me, am I going to be able to ever have sex again? Mm-hmm. And others who didn't even realize that was something that they potentially would have difficulty with. So we're really trying at MedStar, we're really trying to arm our therapists with more information and knowledge so that they can better educate their patients. And from a global perspective, we're trying to prepare our physicians and psychologists and everyone in the department so that everyone knows what role, like whose role is to do what. Who's supposed to talk about medications and their effect on sex? Who's supposed to talk about positioning, the psychological aspects? So we're trying to figure, we're trying to play this dance.
So what did the process start? Like you talked to the senior therapist and you kind of decided, yes, you needed to do something. So what was the process to get those resources rolling?
So the beautiful thing about MedStar is we have a great group of seniors where they take kind of the initiatives of us young therapists and they say like, yeah, like you want to work on that? We want to work on that too. So I kind of gave it to the senior and then they sent it out to our whole staff and asked who's interested in this. And now we have a committee of about 10 people that come together. And like we meet once a week and it started with like, what is being taught? Like, what are the barriers? What education is out there to begin with? And we kind of set out to, yeah, like every week we meet and we try to like figure out like what needs to be put together. So most recently I put together, like we had one therapist put together the whole like generic handout that it's 2 pages, one that's just like general things like after an injury, what to be aware of when returning to sex. Mm-hmm. And then we wanted to see how long would it take to specialize each document for orthopedic precautions, for people who have MS, for spinal cord injuries, for cardiac patients, the whole gamut. So we're kind of slowly starting that process, but it's kind of, the ball has started to get rolling.
That's amazing though, that you have that much support and that much that people are willing to get on board and do the work.
It's, absolutely.
It's a gift from the director to our supervisors to these seniors, where no matter what it is, we go to them and we say, this is what we want. Like, how can we make it happen? And they're like, we're going to make it work if you're willing to put the work in. So like I'm doing a continuous education on how we do sex ed on the pediatric unit in October with 2 seniors, just trying to figure out like what is being taught at what sex ed is being taught at our like DC public schools, Maryland public schools, Virginia public schools, and how does that conversation change after an injury on this unit?
That's fantastic. So what have you learned about what's being taught?
So it's kind of a mix, right? Like DC, Maryland, Virginia are all different, and I'm still waiting to get the information back from the Maryland side to see like what's being taught on that end. But the public schools, it's very like anatomical, standard physical education, kind of here's how babies are made, here's what needs to be done. But one thing that bothers me is that I don't think we're giving, sorry, another phone call from the wife. One thing that bothers me is we're not teaching, in my opinion, we're not teaching kids early enough about safe touch. Mm-hmm. And I think you guys talked about this in an earlier podcast on, you had someone on who had a son with autism. Mm-hmm. And just like the concept of this vulnerable population and how are we educating them on like, everyone's touching you, everyone's seeing you without clothes in this facility. When is it okay outside of this facility? So that's another like topic that we're hoping to broach as we move forward with this. But I think all of this starts with making therapists comfortable and competent in their knowledge of this topic.
So speaking of comfortable confidence, as a student, because you've been practicing a year, you said, I think?
A year, yep.
So think back to your level 2 experiences. Did you get practice with this during your level 2 field work?
I got practice. So I was a student at MedStar, and I got practice with it a little bit. We have a sex ed kind of educational series where we like essentially throw in a video from the Mayo Clinic and lead a conversation. And we have a trained therapist that has resources, that has the conversation. I got to sit on that and lead it with a patient. But outside of that, I did 3 months in mental health, and it was not something talked about. Like, we honestly avoided it because we were afraid of it going a different direction. So whenever I would bring it up to my supervisor, he said, yeah, just redirect them in different, to a different topic.
Oh,
yeah.
Sad.
Yeah, right? Because it's important, right? And like you guys talk about in the podcast, and like what I firmly believe in, this is an activity of daily living, and it shouldn't be getting in the way. Like, your whatever you're dealing with should not be impeding your ability to live your life.
And it's a quality of life issue. And if people are bringing it up, that means it's a problem for them.
And it's important. Yeah. And not just it's a problem, but that it's important.
It brings me back to the podcast that we had Andrew Gerson on when he said he brought it up, and it just kind of got shoved under.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I went and spoke to one of our psychologists at work, and I was like, what, like, are you talking to patients about this? When is this coming up? And she mentioned most of the time in the inpatient facility, patients feel like they're in the thick of it, right? They're in these fires, and the last thing on their mind is if they'll be able to have sex if they can't wipe their ass, right? So they're having this horrible cognitive dissonance. Like, I don't want to deal with that right now. But then they keep pushing it back, and no one brings it up. So 2 years down the road, they're like, oh yeah, that sex thing, I would love to do that again. But
do you really think that it's not on the front of their mind? I'm thinking that that documentary Murder Ball, I don't know if you're mad about
that. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure in that they talk about how, like, I don't care how I'm going to tie my shoes or something. I care how I'm going to jerk off. I think at some point they say that.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that's a fair statement to say that our clients are thinking it. I think they're not, they don't know they can talk to us about it. I think they're thinking it 100%.
Yeah, I would agree. I think the one issue that we run into, we tend to have patients for an extended period of time in our facility. So especially having conversations regarding masturbation, we have this blend of, like, how do we allow a patient to have this privacy when they're in a shared room?
Yeah.
Or when people are coming in every 15, 30 minutes for vitals. Or if I put a sign on the door, like, hey, don't come in here for 15 minutes, right? Like,
sometimes 15 minutes isn't enough.
I know, right? Exactly. Right? So finding that balance has definitely been tough.
So what kind of strategies have you employed in that type of situation where someone wants to masturbate in an inpatient rehab and there isn't privacy? How have you addressed that?
So it takes a special circumstance, especially in our facility, where the patient needs to have a private room, right? Mm-hmm. And constant communication with, like, the psychologist, with the team. And just to be frank with you, we haven't been successful.
Okay. Right.
So that's
the reality of life,
yeah.
You know, of what, like, that setting looks like. So yeah.
Yeah. And part of it, again, oh, go ahead. What was it?
What do you think could be done to make it more successful?
I think
everybody
should
masturbate.
Right. I agree.
How do we get there?
I think the big thing, a big barrier for us, I think one thing that we can't get around with is private rooms, right? Like, if we don't have a private room, that's going to be tough. So I think ways that we can improve is our communication with the patient and how they communicate their needs back to the team. So you tell us that you want from 7 p.m. to 9, or 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. distraction free. Where this is your time to do what you want, we can put a sign on the door that says, do not come in between these hours. Mm-hmm. We already do that for patients who get frustrated as nurses come in to do meds or vitals or whatever it might be, right? Like, stay, like, don't come in between 9 p.m. and 6 a.m., right? If it's not medically necessary for them to have these consistent check-ins, then we can improve that on that end. And also to your point, Kay, where if we did a better job of having this conversation with our patients. Like, I've had a few patients with ataxia where if I could show them the proper technique to do it, mm-hmm. and that they are able to do it, and have like, just give them that mindset of like, if this is important to you, you can make this happen. Mm-hmm. If I gave that to them, then they'd be more inclined to do it and push for the time. But the conversations aren't being had. They're going months at this facility sometimes, weeks at this facility, where they don't have any privacy. They don't have any alone time.
Which is going to like dive into mental health issues.
Right. And well, and then I'm thinking too, you know, in individuals that may have, you know, significant others or partners, you know, what does that then do for not only the individual who has the injury, but the partner?
Also. Yeah. So recently we had one of our physicians, she wrote an order allowing the patient to cuddle with her significant other on the therapy mat. Like at a certain time, they were able to go in the gym at like 8 o'clock, set up to just go lay together.
Oh, yeah. But that's very interesting, though, that there had to have been a doctor's order.
And I mean, a good chunk of that is for safety, right? Like, I've gone in patients' rooms and the girlfriend or wife or the husband or boyfriend jump into bed with them, and this like twin XL college style bed that reclines up, they're laying together, and I'm like, knock knock, hey, you're for therapy, can I come in?
but yeah. Order for cuddling is, there's a good side and a bad side
to that. Right? Yeah, like we're willing to do it, but again, there isn't a push for it. And another issue that we're really running into is who truly is appropriate to be having this conversation with, mm-hmm. right? I mean, especially on our traumatic brain injury unit, we have a hard time knowing, depending on what level they're at, when to bring up the conversation, mm-hmm. right? And this is not my expertise on that end, but our people in our, like, it's called Let's Talk About Sex Committee, they really lean in about like, we're trying to find the right time to bring this up, mm-hmm. to have this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there is a right time? I'm not sure there is a right time. And I kind of wonder if part of our issue as a profession is we're so busy trying to find the right time that we just, then it just never happens.
It never happens. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden they're discharged and we're like, shit, we really should have brought up sex.
Yeah. And they're gone. Yeah. Yeah, I think there is a right time with the right person.
Yeah.
Right?
I think when, that's critical, like, mm-hmm. what you said, the right person, and who is that right person for that individual, and that could vary from person to person.
Yeah.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. I think that's what makes it tough. I think one thing that just talking about sex at, like, at work with this committee, I've really improved in my evaluation skills. The first thing I say is, I'm going to come in here. I'm going to teach you how to put your clothes back on. I'm going to teach you how to shower. I do everything from going to the grocery store to having sex. Mm-hmm. So even like planting that seed in their head.
I think that's like, really important.
Yeah.
And that's part of that. We go to the implicit model, which we've talked about. That's that first permission that we're giving. Like, mm-hmm. we're just mm-hmm. planting that seed. Like, it's okay. I can address this. We can talk about this. When you're ready.
Yeah. And even though looking at those different models that we've talked about in terms of the recognition model, mm-hmm. like that's exactly what you guys are doing with this team, this mm-hmm. Let's Talk About Sex
100%. Team,
is that you guys are recognizing as healthcare professionals that this is an important topic that needs to be discussed. Mm-hmm. And that I always feel like is the number one, because if we don't realize that, then how can we give somebody permission?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%.
Mm-hmm. So other disciplines are involved, right? Not just occupational. Yeah. So what other disciplines are involved in this?
So in the Let's Talk About Sex Committee, that's just occupational therapy.
Okay.
But, sorry, I have to step outside for 1 second. My air conditioning is incredibly loud. So the Let's Talk About Sex Committee is just occupational therapists. But what we're doing is we're reaching out to the psychologists, we're reaching out to the physicians, trying to figure out, again, like, what are the rules? Like, we should be talking about this, but what should we be talking about?
what is in your domain, what's in my domain, how do we make this all work? So it's just kind of needing to, like, we all get together. One thing that I'm working on is developing a focus group with our pediatric team to, like, sit down with everyone and say, like, what is the best way to approach this with the parents, with the child? Like, does the parent need to be present when I'm having this conversation with a 16-year-old?
Mm-hmm. So, is there an answer?
These are all questions that I need to kind of go
in that scenario.
So, what we gathered from that was, once they're in our care, the parents kind of sign over, like, we're going to be educating the kids on loads of topics. So I'm okay with having that conversation with them. I still talk to the parents about it so that they feel comfortable with me having the conversation with their kid. Just be like, this is one of the things that we talked about that came up in our session today, kind of offline out of the session. But for the most part, they're in our care.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is nursing involved?
Not as much as they should be, right? Again, I don't know what their role would look like mm-hmm. in this conversation, but they're, like, when it comes to, like, wound management and managing wounds, mm-hmm. like, before sex, like, the fact, or even ostomy bags, I know that's something that you guys have talked about, but I think a nurse is 100% in their realm.
Mm-hmm.
They are involved on the spinal cord team, part of the education series. It's OT and nursing, mm-hmm. where they kind of go over the sex topics. what role do you think nursing could play?
I think you kind of covered it. I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with the management of things, ostomies, catheters. I think education on medication, nursing would play a role in.
Well, especially mm-hmm. how that's going to affect sexual mm-hmm. function.
Yeah.
Can you think of anything else, JJ?
I mean, I'm sure there's probably other things. But we need a nurse to come on.
I know, now we need a nurse.
I know.
we need a transdisciplinary team here to talk about.
I think to your point, though, I think nurses do play a valuable role in the sense of, I think they could be one of the first people to give permission,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, yeah. I think nurses have such an intimate relationship with their patients that even though I see my patients for an hour and a half a day, like, they're there with them all day long.
Yeah.
So I think nurses could play a huge role in building up their self-confidence, self-image, just by listening to them and, like, being present with them in those moments of making them think about their relationships. Or I had a patient recently who had a crush on one of the nurses, and I had to kind of go into this conversation about, like, well, let's just talk about, like, your dating life. Let's kind of redirect this into a different direction, which also just isn't being brought up.
Yeah.
I mean, if these are the people that you're around day in and day out, and that you're not being intimate with in terms of a sexual term, but are very intimate in terms of your life, your daily life, that, you know, it's kind of that natural.
And if we're talking about an acquired injury, if we're talking about something like spinal cord injury, they're going to be the people that aren't alarmed by anything. Like, families dealing with a lot, families seeing new things and dealing with new things, where this team of healthcare professionals comes in, and we should hopefully calm, cool, collected, casual, which adds to that intimacy level of, like, oh, this person isn't freaked out that whatever happened to me.
Right.
That was a hard lesson I learned as a student on my level two. Of someone who definitely developed feelings for me that I was like, I didn't have guidance as a student for how to deal with it, because it was mm-hmm. and it was just that I was like, I was the one there helping them through all this stuff, and I was listening to them, and I wasn't freaking out like a lot of their family was, and then all of a sudden it became real clear. I was like, oh, he's misinterpreting this,
right?
And that's really difficult to navigate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I have good answers for that, other than being really aware that you need to establish clear boundaries,
right.
And you look for those cues that that's coming on.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that we're really trying to develop in this committee is this concept of safety for the patient and also for the therapists who are having the conversation, right? Like, I am abundantly blessed that as a male, I'm able to have these conversations confidently with other men, and I don't typically have to worry about any backlash, but that isn't the reality mm-hmm. for the majority of our staff. So we're trying to arm them with the tools and tricks to have this conversation in a way that's safe, not sending other messages, or that could be perceived in different ways. And we just want to make sure that everyone feels comfortable with having this conversation.
Mm-hmm. 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 So let's explore. I like exploring this team approach thing. Let's talk about other team members.
Yeah.
Talking a little bit earlier about speech therapy and speech therapy's role in addressing sex and intimacy
and relationships.
Oh, yeah.
And the whole social skills parameter that kind of goes with a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in my eyes, I 100% see speech's role in terms of how are we communicating our needs during sex, before mm-hmm. sex and after sex, but really yeah. during sex. On top of all the oral motor work required to like make out, to yeah. give a blowjob, to do all these different things, right? Like,
right.
who's don't training?
What about cunnilingus?
Right. Oh yeah, not leaving that out. Don't.
Many types of oral.
Sorry. I just want to go through the list, okay?
Right. I never really thought about the oral motor aspect.
And sure, we're trained in that, but when you look at a profession that is just so well versed in how all of this functions, I mean, they could play an impeccable role in building up the strength and building up the foundation. Mm-hmm. And I have no idea if that's something talked about in speech pathology realms or
now I need to get some of my speech friends on.
That's what I'm saying. We just need a whole team to
yeah.
put all this stuff and what perspectives different team members then can bring to the
writing
table.
A goal to increase oral motor strength for oral sex.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, and then
right.
and then that goes right into physical therapy. Yeah. I mean, if a physical therapist was given the freedom to just like say, I mean, this is what I want to do. These are the muscles that I need to build up so that I can get on my knees and get behind, or so that I can get on top, right? Mm-hmm. Like, how empowering would that be if that was your session?
Yeah, if you need just like 5 more degrees of hip flexion to get in your
yeah.
favorite position.
How do you thrust?
We're still trying to figure that one out for Andrew.
Yeah, our buddy Andrew asked us, how can he thrust?
We're working on it. What other team members?
So I guess my question, because I've talked to some friends of mine that are physicians, how comfortable are the physicians with? Because I feel like there's some physicians that are totally on board with this. Like you said, like the mm-hmm. one that's writing the order for mm-hmm. cuddling, and then there's
yeah. some
that
the
like, don't necessarily think that it's as important.
Writing an order for cuddling, but would they write an order for sex?
Right.
Like, is the comfort level there?
Right. Yeah. Our physicians are fantastic, and they do a fantastic job. Logistically, I don't know if that's something that could be done in the hospital. I don't know if it has been done in our hospital where we have someone. Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to even think of a scenario where that would be, okay, especially because we have double rooms.
Yeah, I guess even not even going that far, but are they comfortable with that aspect with their patients? And are you seeing
yeah. that
the physicians are on board with the topic of sex and intimacy?
From that side, yes. I am seeing that conversation being had. The physicians are talking to them about that.
So here's my next question. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's because it's primarily spinal cord?
I mean, to be honest, based on what I've seen, yes. Like,
I feel like it's the culture of spinal cord injury rehab to address mm-hmm. that.
On the PED side, it's not a conversation we have, right? Like, even my peds patients with spinal cord injuries, I tell them, like, here's the education. I go through the educational sessions with them, but they still, it's like the doctor doesn't bring it up. The patient doesn't bring it up to the doctor. So they're just not having that conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. Which goes back to like when our first episode, when like spinal cord injury, it's kind of, it's established. We still have a lot of work in that area, but it's probably better than most areas of practice.
Yeah. Because you said you also work in with individuals with TBI. So the physicians that are working with those individuals with TBI, you know, I guess compare and contrast, what does that look like then, those physicians working in spinal cord injury?
So for what it's worth, only being there for a year, I really spent most of my time on the orthopedic and spinal cord team.
Okay.
I haven't spent much time on the – I haven't spent any time on traumatic brain injury or stroke. Okay. So it's more me – taking coverage and having these conversations with people when I get the chance.
Yeah. I'd be curious though to see kind of what's the difference and how it's being addressed in those two different areas.
Yeah.
From different professionals.
Right. Because I mean, one of the senior therapists on my team, she was the first one to say, you don't need a, like in our whole document or like the presentations and documents we're putting together, we kept saying like need a doctor recommend, like talk to your doctor before doing this, like make sure you have the doctor sign off before you do that. And she was the first one to say, after a stroke, you don't need a doctor to tell you can return back to having sex. Mm-hmm. You can go back to having sex, no problem.
But I think people feel like they need to be told.
It's that concept. And I think we talked about this with Mark, that it's that Dr. Mark Levant, that it's this concept of this authority that the, you know, the physician or the therapist or the nurse or the person that should be telling them. So they're waiting for that. Where then at the same time, the healthcare professionals waiting for the individual to bring it up. And it's kind of like, then you get to the wall.
And then
like, they're not bringing it up and they're waiting for the professional to bring it up. And everybody's just at a standstill.
100%. And I really think, I mean, I thank God for my education, because sex was talked about so much at Creighton University. They talked about it day one. We had it in like our aging class. We had it in our phys rehab class, where it was just ingrained in my mind that like, this is something that you should talk about.
Creighton.
Woo-hoo! Go Jays.
Because it's all over, it seems like it's all over the board. There's some occupational therapists and occupational therapy assistants, students that are not getting it at all. Mm. And there's some where it's like constant,
where it's completely embedded. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I remember my first phys rehab course where my professor, she talked about, you got someone with burns. How are they going to have sex?
Yeah.
Total body burns. And then she talked about, here's what we're going to do. Because, I mean, we're in our first year. We don't know anything, right? So she said, here are the pads you're going to make. Here are the positions they're going to be in. Let them go live their life.
Love it. Because even burns and everything, but, like, not just sex, but masturbation. And if you're talking total body burns, we're talking burns on a penis, the clitoris. And if we're not,
penis,
we're not that, bringing that up. I mean, people have got to be sitting there looking at their new genitalia thinking, how's this going to work?
Or, you know, if there's some sort of traumatic injury where there is no more genitalia.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which we found
that.
Yes. Yeah. I think I do have a question, because I feel like this also, too, comes up is, you know, we can't address this because how do we bill it? How do we code it? How do we get reimbursed for that? So how do you guys handle that aspect of it?
I mean, straight up, guys, we treat sex like an ADL. When I do this, I treat this as an ADL.
All right, great. Yeah,
I am billing this as an activity of daily living, which educational based. And we actually just recently developed a whole, in our whole educational system, there's a button to click to say that I educated the patient about sexuality.
Oh, good.
Do they need more? Yeah. Like, do they need more information? Do they demonstrate an understanding? Do they verbalize the understanding? So, all part of it.
And I think the more people the more practitioners get it in their head that sex is an ADL, as I love to say, the more the easier it is to bill it. Because I know that's what Catherine Ellis, I think that's what she said she billed.
Yeah.
Was self-care management. Yeah, I think there's a lot of things, I mean, well beyond sex and intimacy that we should be billing under self-care management. That we
right. 100%. Right. We just need like a whole education tab.
Yeah.
Where it's like, here, teachers today.
Yeah.
And here's what we're trying to figure out.
Yeah.
I think the other issue we run into is this, like, the mental health piece, the self-confidence piece of you deserve to return back to sex. You can feel sexy. You can feel attractive, you can feel wanted, especially in the inpatient rehab facility. I mean, we've got people who wear hospital gowns their whole stay.
Yeah.
And don't have haircuts.
Do you encourage clients to, I always encourage people to get their street clothes on as soon as possible because I think it just
as kind of soon as possible. The issue you run into is people with ostomies and people with wound vacs. And they say, I don't want this to leak onto my clothes and I don't want to ruin my clothes. And I said, I'll go to Goodwill. I will buy disposable clothes. I don't care.
Yeah.
And they're like, it's too much of a mess.
Oh, it's hard. Ostomies in particular. It's hard in the beginning with an ostomy because you're trying to deal with all of the adhesive and getting great products and what sticks and what doesn't stick. And there are a lot of leaks in the beginning. But yeah, street clothes make a world of difference in self-esteem and your
Yeah. Oh yeah. I took this scene from, do you guys watch Queer Eye at all?
I do not.
You don't?
I haven't watched the reboot of it.
Okay. No,
I watched the reboot.
Anyway, I stole it straight from the show. I'll just admit it right here. But I had a patient that just had a lot of negative self-talk. And I wrote down the negative things he said about himself, about what he looked like, about what he sounded like, about the wheelchair, about all these things. And I wrote it on this mirror. And I was like, these are all the things that you're saying about yourself. And then I erased them. And then I took in things that like I saw about him. Then I had him talk about things that he saw about him. And then I left him alone in the room where he just looked at the mirror of himself and the image of himself. And I don't think we do. Yeah, I don't think we do enough of that.
No.
Of that
and you know, I think it gets stifled a little because I've heard stories from students who try to do some of that, where like writing positive affirmations and they kind of get like poo-pooed saying, no, you can't build that, that's not functional, where you can build that and that is functional. But I think more people need to be thinking that like we should be doing stuff like that. I love that.
Yeah.
Right? That's fantastic. I lost my train of thought. Totally forgot what I was about to say.
Oh, you're fine. But I think that's also a huge barrier to people returning back to sex, right? Like, I tell someone.
Yeah.
Right?
So, and also. Like, this is actually what I was going to say, dating and relationships. Do you approach that topic and how to navigate dating?
Yeah.
And so even environments and like where you may have your favorite place to take someone on a date is maybe no longer accessible to you if you're now in a wheelchair, something like that.
Yeah. And I would say, I think I kind of have to balance that a little bit where it's like, again, right person, right time, right? Where if the person functionally is at the point where they're able to go on dates and able to do these things and they haven't been discharged yet, then I'll bring it up. And the way I kind of introduce it is kind of like what you're talking about. It's like, okay, yeah, we can't go to this bar that has 20 steps to get up, right? We can't do these rooftop bars. What else can we do? How can we incorporate like picnics or finding accessible bars? What apps allow us to find accessible places in our environment to go on dates? How do you write your Tinder profile? How do you write your Hinge profile? What does that look like now that you're in a wheelchair or now that you've had this traumatic brain injury, right? Like, how do you develop this confidence without, and this like self-ownership without lying?
I love that you just brought up like Tinder and all like the dating apps, and because that is such a big part of, I feel like, this culture that we're in now, that's how people are finding people and dating, and you know, and to not ignore that piece, and that's still something that needs to be addressed.
That would be a fun goal to write too.
Developing a Tinder profile.
Yeah, 100%.
That would be fantastic.
Taking sexy selfies.
Yeah, I think the concept of sexy selfies is not talked about enough. I mean, in general, right? Feeling confident in your ability to take a selfie, but then with our patients, right? Like with our clients.
The art of consensual sexting.
Yeah.
Yeah. The accessibility of that. Oh, we're just opening up all sorts of things I hadn't really thought about.
That's the point of this podcast, right?
Completely the point of the podcast. Do you remember the first time you had to address sex with a patient?
Yeah, I was a student.
Tell us about it.
So he was a 26-year-old male with a gunshot wound, and I was 24 at the time. So I just like saw his life and my life, and I was like, there's no reason why these roles aren't flipped. Yeah. Like, this is pure fate, right? And it just kind of, it freaked me out a little bit. So I talked about like my relationship with my wife and how like important sex is in our life, and just being able to show that. And I asked like if he had that like same desires. So I was like, do you have any issues or like with returning back to sex? And he's like, I do. And I think the piece that I had to do was kind of allow myself to open myself up a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. Open up the door about the things that are important to me. So that, yeah, right, there it is. I didn't believe it in OT school, and then here I am using it every day. Okay, that works. but I remember it being hard at first, just to kind of like, I don't know, I had like butterflies and was like, oh, should I bring this up? Should I talk about this? And then I kind of just jumped off the deep end. And I was like, after I talked about like my relationship with my wife and had that question, I brought him into like the room that had like the videos, and like we showed the videos, and he was really quiet. And he was a complete injury. And he's like, what does this look like for me? Like, I'm still confused. And I had to go back to my CI at the time, and I had no idea. Again, I jumped in the deep end without any life vest. I was completely clueless. And she like gave me a bunch of resources from Craig, from Shepherd, to kind of help navigate this conversation. So once I got that first one out of the way, mm-hmm. like it's been a lot easier ever since.
Yeah. The more you talk about it, I actually kind of feel bad for my friends and family at this point, because I'm so used to talking about sex on the podcast that it comes up in like every conversation I have.
I was talking about it today. Always.
But I think that's good too, because then people are just getting to talking about sex. They should. Do you have any final advice for practitioners on just how to bring it up with clients, or how to get the ball rolling in whatever facility you're working at to get more of a team approach?
Yeah, I think doing a kind of scope of what is currently being taught at the facility, mm-hmm. and seeing what the psychologists are teaching, what the physicians are teaching, what therapists are talking about sex, where are they getting their information from? And you can all come together and make something as one. I am a firm believer of this kind of unified front, right? Like, I think the interdisciplinary model is one of the greatest healthcare models, and I think it applies directly to this. So
we don't do enough.
Yeah, right.
We talk like, about it, but then we don't necessarily all do the interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary.
Right. Like we sit in our silos. So I think my one piece of advice is, I mean, if it's important to find out that if it's important to your patient or your client, do the research, do the homework, do what needs to be done, and kind of jump off that diving board, mm-hmm. right? If it's okay if you don't have any life vests and you have no idea what you're saying at first. Because the one thing, again, that Creighton taught me is the best thing you can say as a practitioner is, I don't know, but I'll find out.
Thank you so much for saying that. That's the one thing I tell my students all the time, and I tell everyone all the time. If there's one thing I don't trust in a healthcare professional, it's one that thinks they know everything. I want somebody that's willing to tell me, I don't know the answer, but let me go find out.
Right.
Yeah. Right. And lesson. Yeah.
Can't even.
I mean, thank you guys for everything you're doing. I mean, genuinely listening to your podcast and like what you two are trying to do with starting this conversation, it's part of what's been driving what we do at our work, right? Like, we spend our time being like, this is what they're talking about at OT After Dark. Like, this is something that we haven't thought about. Like, thank you guys for everything you're doing and appreciate you. Best of luck with everything you guys keep doing.
Thank you so much.
Sam, this has been a fantastic conversation. We really appreciate you being on OT After Dark.
You bet. Thank you guys so much.
Well, I don't know about you, Kay, but I had a blast talking to Sam.
I know, Sam. I'm loving Sam. We might have to talk to him again in the future.
I know. Get his whole team together.
Oh, that would be great.
Oh, fantastic. The
whole talk. Maybe pull in some team members that aren't that involved and see if we can get the wheels turning a little more. I think some highlights for me were this idea of the team approach and really speaking up. It helped that where he works, there's a lot of support there, and they were willing to give, which I should have asked. I mean, they're obviously giving them some breakout time away from treatment to work
to
on
be
this.
Able to talk yeah. about this and bring that community of practice together.
Oh, community of practice.
I know, right?
You know, I have plans for a community of practice around sex and intimacy. We just got to figure that out.
Right? Coming soon.
Coming soon.
Everything is always about coming, isn't
about
it?
Coming. It's about coming together.
Coming soon.
As a team.
Coming now.
Coming now.
Just coming.
Any other highlights you think from our talk?
I mean, Sam? I love too, just like the practicality of bill it as an ADL. Like,
don't overthink it.
Don't make the excuse that you're not going to get reimbursed for dealing with sex. It's an ADL. Bill it as one.
Don't overthink how you bill it. Don't overthink. Kind of like sex. Don't overthink it.
Just do it.
Just do it. On that note, sex is an ADL.
Cheers.